live.
We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Let me just check something here. See, looks like you guys on the live stream on Facebook, on YouTube, if you can leave a message if I'm live. Looks like I am. Had a bit of an issue here this morning, but I want to welcome everybody to class. You should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 201. Lesson 201. Okay, so it's on. Thanks for letting me know. All right, lesson 201, the AB 1611, producing a proper perspective on the preface, purpose, number, furniture, and care. So those of you that are joining us live right now on the live stream, part of the problem I've had this morning is I forgot my tablet at home. So I had a quick scramble and get everything printed out for my notes for church. And so because I don't have my tablet, I'm not going to be able to show everything that I normally would be able to show. So if you want to follow along, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under recent sermons, select April 16th, lesson 201, and you'll be able to get the information. Or if you're on YouTube, I did put a link to the notes in the description. Okay, so lesson 201, the AB 1611, producing a proper perspective on the preface, purpose, number, and furniture. So we are getting started a little bit late. We'll do the best we can here, okay? So in lesson 201, lesson 200, we completed our discussion of subsection 12 in which Miles Smith responded to the translator's Roman Catholic opposition. All told, Smith's answer to the imputations of our adversary centered around three different arguments. Number one, Romanists have despised the spirit of grace that gave men the word of God by opposing English translations. Number two, Romanists defended their burning of English translations by arguing that they were produced by heretics. And third, Romanists were guilty of the very imputations that they were leveling against Protestant translators, i.e. changing, correcting, and revising the Latin Vulgate. So we saw all of those things in the last couple of lessons. Okay. So today we want to begin looking at subsection 13, in which Miles Smith addresses four matters pertaining to the translators. Number one, their purpose. Number two, their number. Number three, their furniture, which is a weird use of furniture, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And four, their care. Given the dense nature of the subject matter, we will limit our discussion in this lesson to the following two points. So today all we're going to talk about is what does furniture mean in the title to subsection 13. And second, we're going to talk about their purpose. Okay. Now, we are getting started a little bit late on this lesson, so what I think I'm going to do is skip reading the modern form just for the sake of time, because I can save probably about 4 or 5 minutes if I skip that. So what you'll see there, guys, is you have the title for subsection 13, the purpose of the translators, their number, furniture, and care. And then, as always, I've given you on the left-hand side a modern spelling transcription, and on the right-hand side, the modern form edited by Rhodes and Lupus. So for the sake of time, I'm going to skip reading that this time, just because I'm trying to save time. So in doing that, go to the end of page 3, okay? I think we'll still be fine skipping it. This is a little bit of an easier section to understand, and we're not going to be taking but just a little bite out of it here today. So the first thing I want to talk about then is what does furniture mean in the title to subsection 13. So again, if you're following with me online right now, I've skipped down to the bottom of page 3, where in italics there's a subheading that says what does furniture mean in the title to subsection 13. Okay. So again, if you just read the title, I'm just going to leaf back to page 1 and read the title again. The purpose of the translators, with their number, furniture, and care. Now, how many of you think furniture there sounds weird? A little bit weird. To a modern ear, that sounds a little bit weird. Okay, like what do you mean furniture? When you hear the word furniture, what do you think of?
The chair you're sitting in, the table in front of you, the podium, furniture, the sofa, you know, that kind of bookshelf, a desk, that kind of stuff is the way we typically think of when we hear the word furniture today. But that's not what they meant. That's not what Miles Smith meant in the early 17th century when he used the word furniture there in the title of subsection 13. So let's look at what he means then, okay? So bottom of page 1, bottom of page 3, first bullet point. Subsection 13 is titled The Purpose of the Translators with Their Number, Furniture, Care, etc. Before analyzing the contents of paragraph 15, we must unpack the meaning of the section's title. In the modern form of the preface set forth by Drs. Rhodes and Lupus in the Translators to the Reader, the original preface to the King James Version of 1611 revisited. And again, that's this book right here that I've been using as a resource for this. Okay. The title of subsection 13 has been restated as follows. Quote, the purpose of the translators, their procedures and principles. So the modern form, they've shortened that significantly. They've shortened it down from, so here's what Smith originally had. The purpose of the translators, their number, furniture, care, etc., has been shortened by Rhodes and Lupus to the purpose of the translators, their procedures and principles. Right? So is this a suitable update is what we want to talk about. All right? Is it suitable to update it to the level of that Rhodes and Lupus have done that? Or put another way, what did Miles Smith mean by furniture in this context? We must address this matter before commenting upon the contents of subsection 13. So, top page 4. Smith's use of the word furniture in this context seems a bit odd to modern readers of the preface. Most 21st century readers will no doubt think of the physical objects that furnish their homes, such as couches, desks, bookshelves, lamps, and the like, when they hear the word furniture. It seems odd that Smith would have this meaning in view when he penned the preface. So are there any historical meanings of the English word furniture that might make more sense in this context? This is kind of the first thing that we want to talk about, right? So the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, presents more definitions of the English word furniture than one might expect, at least 9, along with multiple subsenses for some of the major entries. Now, if I had had my tablet, I would have showed you this briefly, that the entry for furniture is extremely long in the Oxford English Dictionary. All right. So, given the confines of time and space, we must limit our comments to the most logical uses that Smith had in mind when he offered the preface. Please consider the following options. So option 1 is definition 1, the action of furnishing. Okay? 1A says the action of fitting or equipping or accomplishing a design or of providing with supplies, occasionally furniture forth obsolete. Okay? Now, when you think of just the action of furnishing, number 1 there, you probably again think about furnishing a house with the necessary things to live in the house, right? But you'll notice right away that in 1A, that's not exactly, there's an old sense here and an old meaning of furniture that is obsolete now. 1A, the action of fitting out or equipping or accomplishing a design or providing with supplies, okay? So if I'm a hiker, for example, and I pack my pack for the hike, have I furnished myself for the hike? Have I outfitted myself with the supplies necessary? So there's a meaning of furniture there that fits that kind of a concept or that sense that is now obsolete that we don't use anymore. All right. Now look at definition 5. Apparatus, appliances, or instructions for work. 5A, material, implements, tools, utensils, rigging, stores, and tackle of a ship, military engines, and defensive works, now chiefly nautical. So you would imagine all the things necessary to furnish a ship. And then B, immaterial. Especially of intellectual faculties or aptitudes, now only with mental or some equivalent defining expression. Okay? So maybe that helps you, maybe it doesn't. So let's look at the next point. After consulting with others on this matter, I have concluded that Miles Smith primarily had definition 5 in view when he used furniture in the title of subsection 13. I take Smith to be talking about the resources they had been, quote, furnished with to accomplish their task. In the body of paragraph 15, Smith states the following, quote, if you ask, now watch how he says this, if you ask what they had before them, truly it was the Hebrew text of the Old Testament and the Greek of the New. These were the two golden pipes, or rather conduits, where through the olive branches emptied themselves into the gold. So in other words, what did they use to do their work? Well, they had in front of them the Hebrew text for the Old Testament and the Greek text for what? The New Testament, all right? So definition 5, apparatus, appliances, or instruments for work. So what would be the necessary instruments necessary to translate the Bible into English? It would be the original language texts, right? The Hebrew text for the Old Testament and the Greek text for the New Testament. And they say in the quote there, notice, that these are the two golden pipes, or rather conduits, where through the olive branches empty themselves into the gold. So in other words, they are beholden to, in their work, the Hebrew and the Greek texts. That's what they're saying, all right? Later, in addition to the Hebrew and Greek texts, Smith identifies additional resources / implements that the translators utilize when conducting their work. Again, quoting from the preface, neither did we think much to consult the translators or commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin, no, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, or Deutsch, being German here, not Dutch. Deutsch being reference to German, okay? So, notice they mention they consulted the translators or commentators in what languages? Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin. So did they look at all the commentators they could, all the other translations in those languages, right? No, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, or German. So they look at all those languages too. So the furniture that they're using in this sense of implements for work are primarily the Hebrew and Greek, right? The Hebrew and Greek texts, as well as the translators and commentators, Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, or Latin, no, nor the Spanish, French, Italian, or Dutch, meaning German in this case, right? So look at the last point on page 4. These were, quote, the furniture that the translators were furnished with to complete their task. Therefore, as the title for subsection 13 suggests, Miles Smith touches upon 4 things in paragraph 15 that he wants the reader to be aware of. Number 1, their purpose. Number 2, their number. Number 3, their furniture in the sense we just explained. And number 4, their care in translating. Generally, Smith sticks with this order with occasional overlap. Now, before we move to page 5, let me just make sure we're clear here, okay? Does everybody understand how they're using the word furniture there? They're using it to refer to the things that they were furnished with to do the job. Yeah, Mike.
Yeah, I looked in Webster's 1828, and there's another definition of furnished that's interesting that also could apply. Number 2, it says, to supply, to store, is to furnish the mind with ideas, to furnish one with knowledge or principles. So they have that aspect there, too.
Correct. So, yeah, they have that aspect of that, and it's coming through these resources that they have to use at their disposal. So the
academic people there.
Correct. And this is look, I'm just going to say this and move on. But, you know, there's a lot of times where King James advocates have this idea that, like, the King James Bible descended from heaven in 1611. Like, just, whoa, you know, came down from on high, sort of like this, right? And when you look at what they said, that is not what they did. Did they look at and consult every single piece of evidentiary information that they had available to them at that time to do their work? This is what they're saying, right? This is the furniture that they had been equipped with. Again, it is the Hebrew text of the Old Testament, the Greek of the New. Those are the two golden pipes or conduits, Smith says. And in addition, they had the translators, commentators in Chaldee, Hebrew, Syrian, Greek, Latin, and they also looked at Spanish, French, Italian, German, etc. Did they look at everything that they knew to look at when they did this?
Yeah,
is the point. Okay, go to page 5. So on page 5 now we're going to look at their purpose. Okay, their purpose. Smith transitions from addressing his Roman Catholic adversaries in paragraphs 13 and 14 with the following sentence at the beginning of paragraph 15. Quote, but it is high time to leave them, that when he says them, he's referring back to his Catholic adversaries in the previous subsection, okay, and to show in brief what we propose to ourselves and what course we held in the perusal and survey of the Bible. Now notice how he's stating that, okay? Let me read it, the last part again. And to show in brief, so that's what he's going to do, show in brief what we propose to ourselves and what course we held in our perusal and survey of the Bible. So in this subsection, is he going to address directly how they did their work, what their goals were, what their furniture was, etc., okay? And the care that they took in doing the job. Notice that Smith characterizes the work of the translators as, quote, a perusal and survey of the Bible. That's what he says. Now, this is not the first time that we've seen Smith use the word survey to describe what transpired between 1604 and 1611. Please recall the title of subsection 3, His Majesty's Constancy, notwithstanding calumniation or slander, for the survey of the English translations. And we talked about that in lesson 194. In our exposition of subsection 3, we connected the, quote, survey of English translations mentioned in the title with the title page of 1611, which stated, let me read that again. In our exposition of subsection 3, we connected the quote, survey of English translations, okay, mentioned the title, with the title page from 1611, which stated, quote, newly translated out of the original tongues, and with the former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special commandments. So, are they talking a lot about a survey of English Bibles? The title of subsection 3 has that language in it. In subsection 15, Miles Smith is talking about our perusal and survey of the Bible. The title page of the 1611 talks about how it's newly translated out of the original tongues and with the former translations diligently compared and revised. So that continues to bear witness to both a translation and a revision. Okay? So it is not a wholly new translation in that it's fresh from scratch. Okay? It's a new translation in that it is a revision of the other ones as a result of their perusal and survey of these Bibles, comparing them against the Hebrew and Greek, the golden pipes, the golden conduits. And then also taking into account the commentaries, the other translations, all that other stuff that we just talked about in all those other languages. Okay? So, moreover, the Epistle Dedicatory stated, quote, for when your highness had once, out of deep judgment, apprehended how convenient it was that out of the original sacred tongues, together with the comparing of the labors, both in our own and other foreign languages, of many worthy men who went before us, there should be one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue. So taken together, the cumulative witness of these statements presents a clear picture of what the King James translators did. According to their own testimony, they compared prior English Bibles with, quote, the original sacred tongues, along with, quote, other foreign language Bibles, to produce one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue. These observations dovetail with what Smith says, with what Smith states next in subsection 13. Quote, truly good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet make of a bad one a good one. I'm going to skip the parentheses here. But to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against, That hath been our endeavor, that our mark. Okay? So it's very clear what they're doing. Regarding the quote purpose of the translator's work, Smith wrote that it was not their quote purpose to make a new translation, i.e., a fresh, holy, new one from scratch. Were they starting from scratch?
No,
they were not. Okay? So, a fresh new... it's not their purpose to make a new translation. What he means there is they did not start from scratch to redo it from as though nothing had been done prior. They were perusing and surveying the prior English Bibles is exactly what they were doing, which is completely consistent with the testimony of the Epistle Dedicatory, the title page, and the preface. Okay? So next sentence. This is consistent with the statement cited above regarding, quote, a survey of the English translations. Simply stated, their purpose was never to make a fresh, wholly new translation of the Bible into English. The following clauses make this expressly clear. Next, Smith states, quote, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one. Thereby clearly stating that the translators, by and large, did not view prior Reformation era English Bibles as, quote, bad or erroneous. So were they terrible?
No.
Okay. But rather, skipping the parentheses, to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one. Okay? So put another way, their purpose was to, quote, survey the English Bibles, so if you're following along on top page 6, that already existed, and out of many good ones, set forth, quote, one principal good one. This statement from the pen of Miles Smith in the preface is completely consistent with what William Barlow recorded in his account of the Hampton Court Conference, The Sum and Substance, as well as the rule set forth by Archbishop Richard Bancroft to govern the project. Please recall the following points from prior lessons. So let's look at Barlow first. He says in the Sum and Substance, quote, whereupon His Highness wished that some special pains should be taken in the behalf, now watch, for one uniform translation, professing that he could never yet see the Bible well translated in English, but worst of all, His Majesty thought the Geneva to be. End quote, Barlow, page 47. Okay? You're laughing.
He thought the Geneva to be.
He thought the Geneva was the worst, but his goal is for there to be one uniform what? Translation. You see that? That's what Barlow says.
Mm-hmm.
Please note the following points of interest from Barlow's account. Number one, King James expressed, quote, that he had never yet seen a Bible well translated in English. Therefore, two, James wished, quote, that some special pains should be taken in that behalf for one uniform translation. Simply stated, the king desired, that at the end of this laborious process that he was sanctioning, there would be, quote, one uniform translation of the Bible into what? In English. Now remember, that makes sense because at the time, in 1604, when this meeting happens and James says what Barlow's recording here, remember that there was a division in the English church between the Puritans who liked the Geneva Bible and the Anglicans who liked the Bishop's Bible. And so James is saying we need to have one, he wants one uniform one wow. translation. That's what he wants. Then we go to Bancroft's rules, rule one. The ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed, and as little altered, watch, as the truth of the original will what? So, to the point we've been making, were they starting from scratch?
No.
They were starting with the Bishop's Bible as a starting point. And then were they comparing the Bishop's Bible against the original Hebrew and Greek? And then the commentators and translators and then all those other languages? And once they had done that, once they completed that perusal, that survey, to use their terms, to use Smith's language, then did they arrive at what they thought was the best reading? Okay? Then rule 14, these translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the Bishop's Bible would be Tyndale's, Matthews, Coverdale, Witt Churches, which is the Great Bible, and Geneva. So the preponderance of historical evidence furnishes us with a cause, with a case, excuse me, of cumulative force. But the King James translators, in accordance with the King's desire for, quote, one uniform translation, and the rules set forth by Bishop Bancroft, accomplished their purpose in surveying existing English Bibles and comparing them to the original sacred tongues to arrive at, quote, one principal good one. You guys following this?
Yep.
Okay. So before moving on, we should pause to make sure that we define the word principal in the phrase, quote, one principal good one. The OED presents the following relevant meanings for the adjective form of principal. Number one, general senses. Definition one, of a number of things or persons. So of a number of things or persons, or one of their number belonging to the first what? Rank. Among the most important. So one meaning of principle is you have, let's say you have 10 important points. There's one principal point, meaning it is the highest point, the best point, among the other good what? Points. Okay? So again, of their number, of a number of things or persons, or one of their number belonging to the first rank, among the most important, prominent, leading, main equals chief, definite, the definition of chief, adjective meaning number four. And number two, of a particular thing or person, first or highest in rank or importance, that is at the head of all the rest, of the greatest account or value. Okay? Any questions? So, out of the, quote, many good ones, I'm at the bottom of page six. So out of the, quote, many good ones, the King James translators surveyed, they endeavored to make one principal good one, i.e., one that was of the highest rank and, quote, head of all the rest of the English Bibles that they what? Consulted. So did they view this work, did Smith view the work that he is writing the preface to as being the principal good one out of many other good ones? That's what he's saying. Okay? Page 7. According to Miles Smith, their, quote, purpose in creating, quote, one principal good one, as defined in the previous point, was that it was, quote, not justly to be accepted against. Once again, this is completely consistent with James's desire for, quote, one uniform translation, as recorded by Barlow in the Sum and Substance, as well as Smith's previous statements in subsection 11, that, quote, nothing is begun and perfected at the same time. Please recall from our discussion of subsection 11 in lesson 198 that we concluded the following regarding Smith's intended meaning of perfected. Quote, so now I'm quoting lesson 198, page 7. Smith says, yet for all that, as nothing is begun and perfected at the same time. In this occurrence, we see the use of the past tense form of the verb perfect being employed in a context that speaks of the completion of the process that had begun at a prior time. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, there is an obsolete meaning of perfect that means, quote, to complete or finish successfully, to carry through, accomplish. In earlier use only, to bring to fulfillment or full development, obsolete. I believe this was the meaning that Smith had in mind when he used the word perfected in this subsection of the preface. In other words, Smith viewed the work of the translators as completing, successfully finishing, improving upon, or bringing to completion the translational work begun by prior English Bibles. Therefore, Smith concludes that their translational forebears would have no reason to, quote, mislike the King James translators, but would rather, quote, thank them for finishing their work. Now, you remember we talked about that, okay? So, Smith views the translators as having, quote, perfected the English Bible, i.e. completing, finishing the process that had begun before them. Therefore, the, quote, one principal good one the King James translators had completed was, quote, not justly to be accepted against, according to Miles Smith. This, of course, raises the question, what does accepted against mean? So is everybody tracking with how I'm trying to build out this logic here and explain it? Okay? The OED provides four word usage examples for the phrase accepted against. For definition 2a, in the verb form for accept. One of which happens to be in the following line from subsection 8 of Miles Smith's preface titled the translating of the scriptures into the vulgar tongue. So let me make sure I explain what I'm saying there. When you look in the OED, it quotes Miles Smith as a word usage example here for the word accept. All right? He says, quote, the same Jerome elsewhere affirmeth that the time had set forth translation of the 70, skipping the Latin, i.e. for his countrymen of Dalmatia, which words not only Erasmus doth understand to purport, that St. Jerome translated the scriptures into the Dalmatian tongue, but also Sixtus Cenfrius and also Alphonsus a Castro that we speak of no more. Now watch. Men not to be accepted against, because they of Rome do ingenuously confess as much. Now you'll notice, does the phrase there, not to be accepted against, occur elsewhere in the preface? All right? So first note the similarity between how Smith uses the verb in both subsection 8 and here in subsection 13. So look at 8. Men not to be accepted against by they of Rome. And 13, not justly to be accepted against. Does everybody see those? Okay. Notice that both of these are negative statements containing the word not in front of the phrase accepted against. Therefore, whatever the verb accept meant in the early 17th century, Smith is using it in a negative what? Sense. Okay, top page 8. OED entry 2A for the verb form of accept contains the word usage examples from subsection 8 of Smith's preface. The word is as follows. Intransitive. Did I read that wrong? No, that's right. To make, so accept. To make objection. To object or take exception. Construction, against, so that abbreviation C-O-N-S-T in the OED is an abbreviation for construction. So oftentimes, against is a common construct is to combine except and against. Okay, so against, exceedingly common in the 17th century. So we're not going to read the rest of that. You get the point of the bolded part. Okay, I put all of it in there for you if you want to read the whole thing. But look at the next point. While I provided the OED entry for 2A, we are primarily concerned with the bolded portion noted above. The word accept meant to, quote, make objection, to object, or take exception. Then the OED states that it was, quote, exceedingly common construct in the 17th century to couple the word accept with the word against, exactly as we find in subsections 8 and 13 of Smith's preface. To illustrate the quote, common 17th century nature of this construct, as well as for the sake of a completeness, we should also note Smith's other use of the construct in subsection 12 of the preface. Okay? So just drop down for the sake of time to the last line or two. So he's speaking here, he says, or not the vulgar interpreter for halting, none of them fear to dissent from him, now watch, nor yet to accept against him. Okay? Simply stated, the English construct accept or accepted against carries the following meanings according to the OED. To make objection, to object or take exception. Now insert the negative not in front of the construct, and it takes on the opposite meaning, i.e. to not object or take exception with. This means that in the mind of Miles Smith, the King James translators had produced, quote, one principle good English translation that could, quote, not justly be objected to or exception taken with, i.e., it was to serve as the standard English Bible moving forward. Which is precisely what King James said he wanted at Hampton Court when he, quote, wished that some special pains should be taken in the behalf for one uniform translation. So if it's not to be accepted against, that means there's no just reason to do what? Object to it, take exception with it, okay? You guys following that? Any questions? Given the pivotal and potentially controversial nature of this conclusion, prudence dictates that we consider a bit more evidence and not rely exclusively on the OED. While the OED is, quote, the definitive record of the English language, it did not exist in the early 17th century when Smith penned the preface. Consequently, a look at 16th and 17th century English language resources is in order to assist with ascertaining the meaning of the phrase accepted against at the time of the translation. The lexicons of early modern English, LEME, established by the University of Toronto digitally, quote, searches and displays word entries from monolingual English dictionaries, bilingual lexicons, technical vocabularies, and other encyclopedic level works from 1480 to 1755. Okay, and that's a quote from the Lexicons of Early Modern English website. A search of the Lexicons of Early Modern English for the word accepted reveals some interesting findings. Additionally, further refinement is possible if one searches the Lexicons of Early Modern English search result browser window using the keyboard command Control F for the word against. So let me explain, okay? I can go to the Lexicons of Early Modern English and I can run a search for accepted and I get tons of information. So now I have the accepted results on the screen. I can go a keyboard command Control F and insert the word against. So now it will search for exactly occurrences of accepted against, and I can find exactly where that construct appears in the Lexicons of Modern Early English. You guys following that procedure? Okay. This additional search will allow the researcher to isolate occurrences of accepted against the exact phrase we are studying in the Lexicons of Early Modern English. When one does this, the findings are extremely enlightening. Consider the following results listed by year in descending order along with the pertinent entry, okay? So the first hit you're going to get is from when you run this search the way I've described it there, you're going to get a hit from 1607. Now question, is 1607 during the work of the translation? So is this a contemporary definition? So the interpreter or book containing the signification of words by John Cowell is the work. The record, and there's an entry for the word record, and this is what it says. And his person may not be impeached or accepted against, neither in this thing or any other thing. Notice that a person who may, quote, not be impeached may not be what?
Accepted
against. So in other words, you can't make a legitimate objection if the person cannot be what?
Accepted.
Impeached or accepted against. Okay? Is everybody following that? There's an entry from 1611 in a Dictionary of French and English Tongues by Randy Cotgrave. There's an entry for reproach. Reproached, disgraced, blemished, branded, tainted, abrided,
twitted.
That's one a new one to me. twitted or cast in the teeth with, disabled, accepted against. So if you can accept against something, can you bring reproach against it? Yes. If it's not to be accepted against, that means it is above what?
Reproach.
Are you following that? You guys are following this, right? I'm not speaking too much gibberish this morning. I hope not. I'm not speaking in tongues, at least as far as I know. Okay? Then there's one from 1677, an English dictionary by Elisha Coles. And there's this entry, it simply says, December tales, I guess. And there's this, and this is, notice the sentence, the judges, granting a supply of 10 such jurors as do appear, what? Or as are not accepted, what? So whatever these jurors rule, is it final?
Yep.
Can it be objected to? No. 1702, a new English dictionary by John Kersey the Younger. Now watch. Exceptionable has an entry that may be accepted against. So if something is exceptionable, is it capable for you to argue against it?
Yes.
Yes. Then look at the next one. Undisprovable. If it's undisprovable, it means it cannot be proven what?
Against
or wrong, right? And the entry for undisprovable literally says, quote, not to be accepted against. So if something is not to be accepted against, that means it cannot, it's not possible for it to be what?
Disproved.
Okay? Notice how something that cannot be accepted against is undisprovable. Put another way, as the OAD asserted, one cannot take exception with or object to something that is, quote, not to be accepted against. You guys following that?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what I find to be the most fascinating of all the entries is from 1737, a universal etymological English dictionary by Noel Bailey, and he's got an entry there for Bible. In this dictionary, and this is what it says in part, William Tyndale afterwards translated it, and it was brought to England from Antwerp. So he's talking about Tyndale's New Testament translation in the 21st year of the reign of Henry VIII, and then printed. Now watch. But being accepted against, a revision and alteration was published in 1538. So did people take exception with Tyndale's translation?
Yep.
And as a result, did they revise it?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So, and then it goes on to say, a revision and alteration was published in 1538 with a preface by Archbishop Cranmer in 1549 and 1551. Another translation was reviewed by several bishops from then called the Bishop's Bible, and it was again translated in the reign of King James I. Okay? So finding the expression accepted against in an entry for the Bible in Noah Bailey's dictionary is interesting to say the least. So since Tyndale's Bible was, quote, accepted against, it was deemed that a revision was in order. Therefore, it is reasonable to assume that if Tyndale's had not been accepted against, there would have been no reason to revise it, which is exactly what Miles Smith stated in the preface to the AV. In other words, we're going to make out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be accepted against. That's what he said. So the final clause, should say clause, not cause. The final clause of the sentence we have been discussing in this lesson solidifies the, quote, purpose of the translators according to Miles Smith. Quote, that hath been our endeavor, that our mark. So the endeavor and mark of the King James translators were aiming for in their work was the creation of, quote, one principal good English translation that was, quote, not justly to be accepted against. In other words, in the words of our friend and research associate Stephen Hayes, quote, this passage indicates that the King James translators believe their translation should be taken as the standard text of the Bible in English, ranking above those English translations, albeit good, that came before it, and that objections to it should not be entertained without justification. It was not justly to be what? Accepted against. So it is my belief, despite popular sentiments to the contrary, that the translators believed that they had accomplished their purpose. Therefore, the Epistle Dedicatory commends their work to His King's Majesty as, quote, one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue. The work was to be viewed as, quote, the principal good one, i.e., chief among the previous good ones used to create it. Therefore, in the judgment of Miles Smith, it was not justly to be accepted against, and therefore serve as the standard English Bible. The King James translators did their work, the King James translators did view their work as perfect in the following senses. They viewed it as exact, or as perfectly done. We already talked about that. They viewed it as perfect in the sense of OED definition 6b, accurate, correct, specific of a copy representation accurately reproducing and reflecting the original of a thought, notion, or record accurately corresponding to the facts. That definition is now obsolete. And thirdly, perfected, to complete or finish successfully, to carry through, accomplish, in early use, also to bring to fulfillment or full development, now also obsolete, OED verb entry form 1A. Therefore, categorical and or unequivocal statements that the King James translators did not believe their work was perfect are erroneous. Okay? Did they view their work as perfect?
Yeah.
In at least three senses. Okay? In the sense of a perfectly done, exact, in the sense of accurate, correct, accurately representing the original, and in the sense of perfected, completing the process. Okay? Therefore, categorical and or unequivocal statements that the King James translators did not view their work was perfect are erroneous. Smith believed that the purpose and mark of the translators in that matter had been accomplished via the product of their work in surveying and comparing English Bibles with, quote, the original sacred tongues to fulfill the king's desire that there might be, quote, one uniform translation. So, attempts to leverage statements from Smith's preface to advance the argument that the king's translators would have approved of continued revision based upon the modern critical text and or modern text critical methodologies and practice are ahistorical and guilty of the historical error of presentism. So folks, did Miles Smith envision a situation, did he envision that his work that he helped on and that he is introducing to the reader was not to be justly accepted against? Yes, and was that their goal, and was that their purpose in the work that they did in perusing, to use his language, perusing and surveying other Bibles? So now to fast forward now to the 18th century with Westcott and Hort and the advancement of the modern critical text, and to say that the King James translators would have been completely okay with that, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that that would be the case. Okay, now, any questions or comments? No questions or comments. Mike, did I alleviate your question?
I'm not 100% on board with Barlow that the translators thought that their translation was perfect. I think one principal good one and the various other ways that they said indicated to me that they thought it was one principal good one, not necessarily.
So I think we need to understand, in my mind, on that point, the difference between the ultimate meaning of perfect, in the sense of not to be improved upon, and the lesser senses of perfect that they use in the preface. They viewed it was perfect in the sense that it completed the process. They viewed it was perfect in the sense that it was accurate, and they viewed it as exact, perfectly done. But they did not claim perfection in the ultimate sense of being beyond improvement.
Right. That's
And but that's a, but see, when people talk about this issue, they go straight for the beyond improvement issue, and they define everything in the preface by that definition, and that's not accurate. Okay? They obviously, despite this perfection that they viewed in the three senses that I identified in the notes, did they still set forth, in some cases, alternative readings in the margin and the marginal notes, and were, at least according to rumors, a couple of the translators present in the 1630s for a revision of some of the work? They were. So they did not view it as perfect in the absolute sense of perfect, but they did view it as perfect in these lesser senses. That's why I worded it in the notes. Therefore, categorical or unequivocal statements that the King James translators did not view their work as perfect are erroneous. In other words, are there categories of perfect that they did view it as applying to their work? I would say the answer to that is yes. Okay? So, we are right on time. We did get started a bit late. So, next Sunday, we're going to keep working here on subsection 13, and we're going to look at their number and a little bit more about their furniture if we have time, and try to finish subsection 13. But guys, I ultimately envision all this work that we're doing here as being a book. Okay? That goes through these things meticulously, because unfortunately, I view there as a knowledge gap that this published in a book form could really serve the body of Christ in filling in for people. Okay? So anyway, I'm going to